From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's TV Week on Fresh Air. Today we hear from the stars and writers of variety and sketch comedy shows. Carl Reiner and Larry Gelbart talk about being part of the neurotic, egotistical, and sometimes violent comedy team writing for Sid Caesar's variety show. Tom and Dick Smothers remember dealing with censors on the Smothers Brothers show. CBS yanked the show off the air in 1969 because of its controversial content. And David Alan Greer talks about the characters he created and played on In Living Color, the sketch comedy show that also featured the Wayans family and Jim Carrey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's TV Week on Fresh Air, featuring interviews with the stars and creators of classic and current TV shows. Today, sketch comedy and variety shows. The first great TV variety show was Your Show of Shows, starring Sid Caesar. This live 90-minute program ran on NBC Saturday nights from 1950 to 54. Several important writers got started writing for Sid Caesar's various TV shows, including Mel Brooks, Larry Gelbart, Neil Simon, Woody Allen, and our first guest, Carl Reiner. Reiner was also Sid Caesar's second banana on Your Show of Shows. Reiner went on to create The Dick Van Dyke Show and to direct films, including The Jerk, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, The Man with Two Brains, and All of Me, which each starred Steve Martin. Here's a sketch from Your Show of Shows featuring Carl Reiner as a roving reporter interviewing the famous Viennese sleep expert, Dr. Sigmund von Sedative, played by Sid Caesar.
Doctor, I wonder if you can show us your own personal method for falling asleep.
Of course, that's all. See, most of the people, they walk in when they, you know, they just get into bed very gently, you know? My method, you come in to bed, you flop into bed. You flop into bed and you relax a bit. Well, then you concentrate. You concentrate, you say, all right, toes, good night. Good night, toes, come on, go to sleep. When you see right away, they curl up and they drop off. To sleep, they drop off to sleep. Well, then you say, good night, ankles, good night, knees, and pretty soon you see the legs are asleep. When you tell the stomach, come on, good night, stop the mixing in there, hang up the food, go to sleep. When you tell the chest, you did a nice job today, you did work good, stop the breathing, come on. When you tell the throat, come on, okay, stop that. All right, brain, come on, go to sleep. Brain, will you please go to sleep? Come on, everybody else is sleeping, why don't you? Listen, don't holler so loud, will you please? You'll wake up the stomach. Will you please go to sleep like a night? I got a brain that's out of his mind. Will you please go to sleep again? Well, don't holler so much, will you please? You'll wake up the whole... You don't want to go to sleep, huh? You don't want to go to sleep? All right. I got it. All right, everybody up! Everybody. Someday you want to go to sleep, I wouldn't let you sleep. Now, what are you...
I spoke with Carl Reiner in 1989. In the writers' meetings for the Sid Caesar show?
Yes.
Was there ever an air of complete desperation where you had this whole room of really funny people, but they were just on the verge of killing themselves because they weren't coming up with what they wanted to?
Oh, I tell you, you're reminding me now of a moment when, after we'd been on about 2 or 3 years, and we had done 5 sketches a week for maybe 2 or 3 years, and that was an hour and a half show, and one day, on a Monday, we came in, and we sat around trying to fill some of the forms, and everybody came up blank. Everybody had dried up at the same time, and we all decided that was it. We said to Max Liebman, then we said, we're going to come on the air and just sit there, the four of us, Sid Caesar, Imogene Coke, myself, and Howard Morris, and just stare at the set. And then we'd go blank, and somebody would come and say, ladies and gentlemen, there is no more comedy. We have done all we can. No more. This is it. Good night. And we were going to do that. And we laughed about that. As a matter of fact, we decided to try a sketch where we started a sketch, like a vice president, people being ushered into a room, into a salon where they were going to obviously perform a sketch. One by one, they say, Lord Trixton, General so-and-so, they come in and they sit down on a couch and just sit there without doing anything. And we showed it to Max. We said, this is the sketch. We just sat there. And he said, what is that? What is that? We sat for 5 minutes. And of course, everybody broke up. They said, they're not going to do anything. They're just going to sit there. We said, that's it, Max. There's no more comedy. We couldn't come up with an idea. So we think we'd like to do that. America will tune in and say, they're just sitting there. They haven't moved in 5 minutes. One guy crossed his leg, and that was it. We were that desperate at that point. Of course, that week, we probably came up with the best show we ever did.
Several of the writers on the program were Jewish. You, Mel Brooks, toward the end of the
Mel Brooks is Jewish?
That's a shock. Woody Allen worked on the show toward its end, and who knows who else I'm not mentioning here. But I was wondering if you were allowed to do Jewish characterizations, to have Yiddish words or to use a Jewish accent on the show.
I don't think we ever used a Jewish accent. I didn't know. After the war and during the war and before the war, it became, people decided that making fun of any ethnic group was not good for people who were being slaughtered by somebody who thought they weren't worthy of living. So we did use a lot of Yiddish words, especially in our Japanese movies. We did, I remember some of the names, Shtaka Yamagura, Shtaka meaning strong, but it had a Japanese sound to it. Baron Kashimoto, Kasha is a word, as a food. But we always, anytime we used a Jewish word, we didn't allow that to lay out there alone. We always had another joke that everybody who didn't understand the word would be watching at the same time that joke was happening. We were very responsible to our audience not to do inside jokes that only some people would get.
I bet there were a lot of Yiddish-type sketch ideas that you came up with behind the scenes that you ended up tossing out since it wasn't appropriate for TV.
Well, as a matter of fact, the 2,000-year-old man was in the office with us every day, and every time we got bored, I turned to Mel and I interviewed the 2,000-year-old man.
Oh, really?
Who basically was of the Hebrew persuasion. So we had that.
How did you come up with the idea for the 2,000-year-old man? What was the story behind that?
Well, it was a very simple story. I came in one morning, having seen something irresponsible on television, and somebody who actually claimed to have been someplace they couldn't have been, and I said, oh, that's a ridiculous thing. I don't know why they put that on the air. And in anger, I said to Mel, I understand you were actually at the scene of the crucifixion, sir. He's, oh, boy. And then started a 10-year interview that I did every time we got bored in the office. I'd turn to Mel and question about all the people he knew, having lived 2,000 years from Jesus Christ on to the present day.
Now, how did that end up being recorded and being done on television?
Well, we had done it for years at parties. We were always invited to parties, sort of like command performances, and we didn't feel we wanted to do that. We figured we had enough stature to be just invited to eat and talk, but I always brought a tape recorder with me, and I felt that I loved hearing Mel do this, and I wanted to have a record of it. So I had about 10 years of this stuff before we got into a situation where Joe Fields, who was a big writer, producer on Broadway, he used to love it. And every time he'd have a party, invite Mel and I to do it. And he did it on the coast once, the West Coast. And every major star was there. And George Burns came up to us and said, you better put it on record or I'm going to steal it. Eddie G. Robinson came up. He says, make a Broadway play out of it. I want to play that man. And Steve Allen came up and said, why don't you put it on record? And we said, no, no. He says, why don't you let me pay for the tape? I have a little record company. If you don't like it, you can tear it, burn it, expunge it, whatever you want. And we did it. We did it in front of a crowd of 200 people, this whole ad-lib tape for 2 hours. We cut it down to 47 minutes, and it worked. And then we did 4 more albums after that.
I'd like you to meet now a gentleman who I've had the pleasure of meeting and interviewing 2 or 3 times before, the 2,000-year-old man.
Hello there.
Hi,
how are you?
How are
you? Yes, good to see you.
You know, many people still do not believe that you are 2,000 years old, but it has been authenticated.
Yes, it has, certainly.
You are that.
I have a birth certificate in the land of Og. But I don't carry my birth certificate around.
Why?
Because it's a bolded, it's inscribed on it.
Oh, I see, yes. Well, that
can't carry
would be
it.
Cumbersome.
No, credit cards, that's enough.
Yes, sir. Yes. Are there any more secrets you're ready to divulge about why and how to live 2,000 years?
Well, one of the big things that's kept me rolling along singing a song is garlic.
Garlic has
yes.
kept you alive? How can garlic keep you alive?
Well, garlic keeps you alive because, well, you know how you die, don't you? The scientific reason how you die is that the angel of death, see, rings your apartment bell and you let him in and bang, you know.
Comes
in and says, okay, Murray, this is it. And
How does garlic help?
Usually comes at night, right?
Yes.
So before I retire, I'll eat myself a nice pound and a half of garlic. Then I lay down in bed, and I pull up my crazy quilt. And I'll starting to retire and snore.
And how does the garlic help?
Well, the angel of death, you know, comes in. He comes over to me, taps me on the shoulder. I say, "Who is it?" And usually he goes, "Whoo!" He takes right off. He's out the door.
That's an interesting theory.
Sure. You know about the kiss of death, right?
Yes.
Sure, he's not going to kiss me. I'm full of garlic.
I see.
Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks. Our interview with Carl Reiner was recorded in 1989. Larry Gelbart will talk about writing for Sid Caesar after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's TV Week on Fresh Air. Today we're featuring writers and performers from variety and sketch comedy shows. Larry Gelbart wrote for Sid Caesar from 1955 to 58. Gelbart later developed the TV series MASH and served as its principal writer. He wrote the screenplays for Oh God, Tootsie, and Barbarians at the Gate. He wrote the book for the Stephen Sondheim musical, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. In 1996, I asked Larry Gelbart to recall one of his favorite Sid Caesar sketches, and he described a takeoff of Hollywood musicals about three sailors on leave who meet three waitresses who turn out to be heiresses.
Well, Carl Reiner, Howie Morris, and Sid Caesar, of course, played the three sailors who arrive in New York on a 24-hour shore leave and just get involved in really all the movie cliches about meeting girls, falling in love, not being able to get back to the ship, hokey romance, bogus tap numbers, original songs. And I remember it culminated with them all getting married on the battleship and the admiral coming out and saying, "As you know, we always do a big production number on our deck before we go off to war." And we did do a big production number. I guess it must be a favorite because it's the first one that sort of spun around on the wheel decks of my mind when you asked that question.
Do you remember the lyrics to the songs?
Oh, something about uptown's up and downtown's down and east side's on the east side and the west side's. I mean, they were just, you know, Compton and Green,
right.
Or Compton and Green, if you want.
Right. Now, what was it like writing for the Sid Caesar show as a group? Was it a collective process?
It was a totally collective process. We were all locked in the same room together every Monday morning from 10 o'clock until 6. On a Monday morning, we say, "Well, what do we do this Saturday night?" And by Wednesday, we had written an hour show that would have been one or two or three or four sketches, perhaps a mime routine, perhaps some special musical material. And by Thursday, Sid was in the rehearsal hall with the performers rehearsing the material, and it was broadcast live, that is to say, in front of an audience, without laugh machines, without tape machines, without any, you know, mechanical help. By Saturday night at around 10 o'clock, it was all over. We had Sunday to relax and to either enjoy or regret what we had done on Saturday night. And then Monday, it started all over again. But there we were, all in the same room, pitching jokes like crazy. Neil Simon captured it amazingly accurately and affectionately in a play he did a couple of years ago called Laughter on the 23rd Floor.
In an article in the New York Times a bunch of years ago, you described the writing room as supercharged, marvelously competitive, and literally violent. I'd like to hear about the violence.
Everybody wants to hear about the violence. A lot of the violence was directed at Mel Brooks. Mel, God bless him, I believe is the proper cliche at this moment. Mel is a vastly unique and talented man. He could not get to work on time. He was always late. And we resented it. And he knew we resented it, but it didn't stop him from being late. And so there were times when we would burn him in effigy.
Literally?
We would have a hat, a shirt, a jacket or something of him, set fire to it in this office building in New York City on 57th Street. We would throw... Mel once rapped me on the bottom of my feet with a ruler. I was sitting up with my feet up on the desk, and for some reason he just smacked me across the bottom, so they really hurt. And so when I first chance I could get, I threw his shoes out the window. He had taken them off because he was napping or something, and so he had to go downstairs barefoot and buy a new pair of shoes. There was an awful lot of ambivalence in the room, and the negative side of it often resulted in that kind of violence, although not continuously. And we didn't even have time for that kind of nonsense, truly. But we took a moment or two to vent our collective spleens.
I imagine there was a lot of ego and a lot of neurosis in the room.
Probably more neurosis than ego, because when you're in what amounts to a dugout of writers, a battery of writers, you're punching away. You don't smart because one joke, wasn't accepted by the others. You come up with another one. When there's a good one, fine. That then you're one joke closer to having a sketch written, say. So while we all had healthy egos, neurosis. Oh, that we were. We were all very neurotic. Very neurotic. I like to think we all still are. But no one more neurotic than Sid. I mean,
How did Sid Caesar's neurosis get expressed, and how did you deal with it?
Well, Sid was really kind of, walking around encased in rage for a lot of years. I mean, he's talked about his own demons, his substance abuse and stuff. I don't want to elaborate on that, but Sid was a mess, and there were times he would come to the office wearing carrying a revolver.
You're kidding.
A Magnum revolver. Yeah.
Like loaded?
He was, and the gun was too. No, Sid did not drink until after 6 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
So we all used to try to get out of there about 5 minutes to six. But Sid had a lot of anger, and Sid was like a refrigerator in a sports jacket. He was a big man. Sid was Mel Brooks used the joke in Blazing Saddles, but once Sid was horseback riding in Central Park with his wife Florence, and Florence's horse threw Florence to the ground, and Sid got off his horse and punched Florence's horse right between the eyes, and the horse went down. I mean, we're talking about that kind of strength and violence that was, set to go off in any second.
So when he would bring his gun to work, would he brandish it at the at the writers? What would he?
No. Sid, there was a time there for a while.
Oh,
Sid,
I know what he'd do. He'd hold the gun to his forehead and say, "Oh," he'd hold out the gun and he'd say, That those jokes stink. If you want to kill me, use this.
No, he didn't. No, there was a time. Sid went through a paranoid stage where he thought that Otto Skorzeny, the famous Nazi provocateur, was after him.
Oh,
so
gosh.
He was really carrying it in self-defense. Now it becomes understandable, I hope.
Right, that he was having paranoid delusions.
Yeah, that the man was going to surface in a submarine in the East River and come over to 57th Street and get Sid. Sid felt no violence towards us. He really did then, and still does, have a healthy respect for what we did with and for him.
Well, let me ask you, if he thought that someone was out to get him, who clearly wasn't, did you ever worry about how he was going to perform live on television?
No, Sid, we never worried for one second. The only thing we knew that Sid would not be sure of was being able to say good evening to the audience as Sid Caesar. Once he got into any sketch, any prepared material, once he could do a monologue, once he could do a mime, once he could play a character, he was fine. The only person in the world he did not know how to play was Sid Caesar. He had a a neurotic, persistent hack. He would cough. It would be good evening, ladies. He could not say good evening, ladies and gentlemen. That's what we worried about. We thought that would be the whole hour, Sid saying good evening.
So would you have him say good evening in somebody else's character just to get him through that?
No, he had to be himself for a second.
Right.
Sid was often not himself when he was off camera. I mean, we talk about it in that session that we had when we got together. We talk about the fact that for almost a year, Sid spoke with a Polish accent. He, yes, he pretended to be a Polish janitor, a maintenance man, and that's the way he can. That's the way he said good morning. That's the way he had lunch with you, and that's the way he said good night.
Wow, how strange.
So, no kidding.
Was it hard convincing him to do sketches that you really believed in?
No. He was a very good judge of material. All really good comedians are very good editors. They recognize what's right for them. They definitely know what's wrong for them. And he was brave. We would do satires based or parodies based on material that was not generally known or widespread, such as Japanese movies. When we did them, hardly anybody in the audience, the television audience, had ever seen a Japanese movie. We did very esoteric things and very brave things, and Sid was the bravest of all because he was the one out there in front of the camera doing it and risking his his reputation and his ability to make people laugh by doing material that was very, very sophisticated.
Larry Gelbart, recorded in 1996. More on variety and sketch comedy shows in the second half of our program as our TV week continues. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, featuring an all-turbocharged lineup with safety features like the Saab Active Head Restraint System, SaabUSA.com. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of the novel The Man Who Ate the 747 by Ben Sherwood. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on sketch comedy and variety shows. Tom and Dick Smothers remember their run-ins with network censors, which led to the cancellation of the Smothers Brothers show. And David Alan Greer talks about the characters he created for In Living Color, the sketch show that also featured the Wayans family and Jim Carrey.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's TV Week on Fresh Air, today featuring interviews with the creators and writers of variety and sketch comedy shows. The Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour ran from 1967 to 69. It featured guest performers, sketches, and the music and comedy of Tom and Dick Smothers. The show's topical humor and satire made it the target of network censors who frequently deleted sketches and songs. After several censorship battles, CBS fired the Smothers Brothers and discontinued the series in 1969. Eventually, the brothers got a couple of other shows, but they never caught on like the original did. The Smothers Brothers' early act coincided with the folk revival of the 1960s. They often spoofed the seriousness of folk music.
Many folk songs have been written in the first person, the original authentic folk songs. They have been written during the actual occurrence of a historic event by someone who was involved in this event. The song my brother would like to sing now was written in the first person by a man about 150 years ago. It's entitled Hangman.
Hangman, hangman, slack your rope. Hangman, hangman, slack your rope. Slack it for a...
short. We have another song, which is an old folk song, and it hasn't been sung enough lately, we feel. It's been sort of neglected, and it's a very... nice song, and I know you'll recognize it the moment we start. Jimmy crack corn and I don't care.
Jimmy crack corn and I don't care.
Jimmy
I
crack
don't
corn
care,
and Jimmy crack. Wait a minute. That's not the way the song goes.
I don't care. I just don't like that song.
Tom Smothers is the blonde-haired brother who's the guitarist and plays the dimwit. The straight man is Dick Smothers, the dark-haired brother who plays bass. I spoke with them in 1985. Tom told me how their music act evolved into satire.
I would go out there, and for some reason, I always would mimic people. And it would be, we were known as satirists. I didn't even know what the word was until they said the Smothers Brothers satirized the folk music craze. We're just out there. I'd hear someone sing a song, and they'd be deadly serious about it, and I couldn't help but just kind of poke a little fun at it.
And then to make fun in a lighthearted way and just have a really ridiculous story that has nothing to do with the music. Like Tommy had...
Dark as a Dungeon?
Dark as a Dungeon. The most ludicrous would be, they call the wind Mariah. He says it's an old Jewish folk song, Machaya. And then Hava Nagila, where they danced around a hat. It was a rain dance. Actually, they danced around an umbrella. And they, similar to how they danced around hats, the Mexicans, and prayed for hair. And you just the further, the bigger the lie, it just becomes funny.
What's your own ethnic background?
Ethnic?
We have none.
We don't even have a secret.
In search of a background.
We have no food, secret food, family food, handshakes. You know, we're not Jewish, Italian, name it. We're just wasps.
What were your alternatives? Did you have alternative plans if you didn't become performers?
I always wanted to be a comedian. When I first saw George Gobel, who was my first influence, when I was 12, 13, 14, he was doing the Ed Sullivan Show. I thought it was marvelous what this man did. And I'd like to do that, I told my principal. I said, that's what I'd like to do. And so I had a coping problem. I was pretty slow in school. And so I was genuinely trying to get my applause, not through scholastics, but through attention getting. If I was late for class, instead of walking in the back door and sliding into the seat, you know, I walked in the front door and apologized to the teacher and then to each of the students individually until I was sent to the principal's office, really deadpan. I knew I had this kind of a little bit of a gift to get people laughing.
The problem I would expect is if you play a jerk on stage, that off stage people might think that you're dim-witted. Did that ever happen to you, that people would assume, you know, off stage that
I was so
you had the
close.
Persona?
I was so close to my onstage, offstage. There was just a very thin line between...
People would come up to you in a Purple Onion, the first job, and say, why, don't do this. This is so painful. If it's so upsetting to you, don't get on that stage.
Well, that's very good performance, because that's like being in really crawling into the skin of the whatever character you choose, and that was the only one I had. And I was walking down the street in the Purple Onion, and some guy says, could you tell me where the Black Cat Cafe is? I said, yeah, it's just down that one street and turn left. He says, I know where it is. I just want to see if you knew how to give direction. You're so stupid on stage.
What about you, Dick Smothers? Did your persona on stage as the just more practical, down-to-earth persona mm-hmm. apply to the role you really played in your relationship with your brother?
Yeah, I think so. That's the way I am in real life, just exaggerated. I think we exaggerate our natural tendencies when we get into comedy, and then it's believable. You know, if you create somebody who's not there, I think you have to be a superior actor to let anybody buy it. I'm pretty logical. Basically, if things don't make any sense to me, I don't want to do it. And that's the way I control our relationship on stage with Tommy. You know, he would go off on a tangent, and I would correct him.
We're listening to a 1985 interview with the Smothers Brothers. Here they are on stage.
None of the kids like me, and Dickie Smothers had a dog, and I had to play by myself in the backyard. He said, "You got to have a dog, because Mom gave you a dog, and I didn't get a dog. I had
That's
a
right.
chicken. It's no fun playing with a chicken all the time." He didn't even bark. I said, "Bark, chicken, you better bark!"
We'll hear more from the Smothers Brothers after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's TV Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1985 interview with Tom and Dick Smothers. You reached even wider audiences than you had just performing when you got on television as the hosts of your own hour variety show. How did CBS first approach you about that? What did they tell you that they wanted?
Well, a preface to that is that in 1961, we started doing the Jack Parr show, and then we did about 14 shows.
We had 13 the last 6 months Jack was on the air.
We got a lot of guest spots. It was Bing Crosby and
Ed Sullivan. I remember seeing you a lot on the Ed
Sullivan
show.
Later on, Ed Sullivan. Gary Moore, we were...
So by the time we had our own series offered to us with CBS, we did a situation comedy that went 32 episodes, which was totally contrary to any of our experience because there was no audience there, and we had to repeat the lines.
It was shot as a film. You know, it wasn't three camera. It was a film.
And it was a very difficult, very trying time for us.
Awful.
And when CBS came to us half a season later, said, "Here's a variety show," I was so upset with the other show, we said, "We want creative control." And they said, "You got it." Well, they were sending us down the tubes anyway. They didn't expect us to make it.
The time slot was at opposite Bonanza. And Gary Moore just got canceled, and he was the last-rated show in television. So they gave us the worst spot and then gave us everything that Tommy wanted. Because we weren't going to be around more than a few weeks anyway.
So what'd you ask for?
I asked it for creative control. That meant the material, the control
content.
Of the writers, content, the look of the show, everything. And the fact that it really went well. We had a nice cast of people put together by the producers and everything, but it wasn't quite what we wanted, but it evolved, and I got younger writers, got Mason Williams, I'd bring him in. If a writer seemed like he was cliche and was bringing out old material, not creative new ideas, we'd replace him each cycle, each 13-week period, until we had pretty much what I wanted. The Times dictated awareness came about that time in the mid-60s when Vietnam, voter registration, Selma, all those things started coming through, and they started leaking into our minds, our own consciousness, and they started coming out a little bit in attitudes in the show. And our writers were young, and we kind of had this little kind of small group that worked late into the night. None of the other shows did. We'd leave at sometimes 1 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night from reworking sketches and stuff. And everybody had love beads on and sandals. It was we were a real product of the times. And we reflected that viewpoint that was not being
So then instantly, once it was a hit, it was a hit, it was a surprise hit. It really was. Nobody predicted it. CBS wanted us to pull back, didn't want any controversy and anything. They, not realizing the content of the show was in large part of its success. So that was a running battle for 72. I think we did 72 mm-hmm. episodes. It was pretty much a running battle from day one through the firing at the last.
Well, they actually censored, deleted some of the performance excerpts.
That was their legal right. And once they got it, they, I guess by the contracts and stuff, they could take out anything they wanted. But
how would that work? When would you have to deliver the show to them, so to speak?
Oh, that was another whole thing. It changed. It changed every year. We delivered the shows just a normal practice, but I think the way it was about a week.
A strike happened, a musician strike, so that put everything behind. And some of those things, so we were all of a sudden working, taping on a Friday, delivering for a Sunday show. That meant editing with a razor blade. And I, of course, being naive and not knowing anything about television, I involved myself in everything.
Well, but wait a minute. Razor blade means that they did not have the electronic sophistication that they have now. So you actually physically took razor blades and cut tapes and put pieces together, and they worked straight through right after production.
Oh, yeah. Wait, great.
And then they gave it to a girl, and she flew to New York and handed them
these
tapes.
Yes, the New York tape. And so when they would say, we don't like this part here, I say, you must take that out, or we will take it out. I said, well, I'll take it out. And it did take a long time.
What would
to
you
do it?
You'd have to put something back in to replace it.
No, if they wanted out, we presented our contractual obligation, which was to present a show of an hour's length or whatever it was, minus the commercials. After that, they could take it out. They took things out and put in a Nixon commercial when it was political. Of course, I got furious.
What had they taken out to put in the Nixon commercial?
I don't remember.
I do. It was the whole Belafonte piece, Mama Look a Boo Boo. It was the 68 convention news footage from Chicago, the bloody riots and everything, and Belafonte sang some calypso numbers to news footage that had been seen on the air. Nothing offensive about it, except where you'd see Mayor Daley in the news footage at the convention, and the lyric might say "Look a boo boo," or something like that. It was light satire. They took the whole hunk out. It must have been 5 minutes or more.
No, seven.
7 minutes, and put in a huge Nixon thing, which was a little salt in the wound. But it was gamesmanship, I think, a little bit there.
It was hardball.
One of the most famous deleted portions of your program is Pete Seeger singing Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. Mm-hmm. He made his network comeback, really, on your show, didn't he?
Right. Pete Seeger was blackballed for a long time. And when the Hootenanny show was on the air, that was back in the early 60s, we didn't know anything about what this meant. We didn't know about censorship or there was any problem. And we're doing Hootenanny, and there were some kids out, college students, protesting, you know, picket line out there, because Pete Seeger wasn't on. We're wandering around. We don't know anything about it. And when we had our show of Pete Seeger, of course, one of the classic people in the United States as far as folk music and his blues.
He's a troubadour. He's a very gentle troubadour.
So when we had an opportunity to put him on the air, we put him on the air, and everybody who was on our show, they were guests. They were considered guests. What would you like to do? What song? He said, I'd like to sing this song, this song. I said, fine. This is too long. We only have this much time. He chose Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, and, well, it reflected our attitudes and our staff and our writing staff. And we said, sure, that's fine. And they said, no. So I said, feature our guest, feel free. He sang the song, and they took it out. Next time we had him on the show, I said, what would you like to sing, Pete? He says, I'd like to sing Waist Deep in the Muddy, Big Muddy. I said, you're our guest, Pete. And so he sang it again. This time they left it in. So what came to us was there was a constant change of values there. And as the public opinion swung both ways and during the war, Vietnam War, that there was room for pressing another viewpoint.
So do you remember when that first time that he sang Waist Deep in the Big Muddy was deleted by CBS? What did they put in instead?
We have no idea. Can't have to look at my scripts and find out at that time. We could see it coming. Sometimes the week of the show rehearsal, during the run-through on a Wednesday for a Friday taping, the censors would be running around or broadcast standards would be crazy. So, well, you can't say this. You can't have this. We kind of knew in advance that we were going to have a problem. Sometimes we'd win, sometimes we'd lose.
Would you fight a lot?
Oh, yeah, constantly. One time during summer show, the Glenn Campbell show, I'd play ping pong with the program practices guy, who was very good, nice guy. I was just following orders. And we'd play for a 2 out of 3 for a particular line or a particular attitude in the show.
That's funny.
But we look back on it now, and it was a social situation that was heading. It came to culmination, of course, but it was interesting.
Tom and Dick Smothers recorded in 1985. We end today's program on TV variety and sketch comedy shows with David Alan Greer, one of the very funny people who got started on In Living Color. This sketch comedy show was broadcast Sunday nights on Fox from 1990 to 94. A lot of viewers came to think of it as a younger, hipper, blacker answer to Saturday Night Live. The show also gave Jim Carrey his start and showcased the talents of Keenan and Damon Wayans and other members of the Wayans clan. In 1991, while In Living Color was on the air, I spoke with David Alan Greer about some of the characters he did on the show. We started with Clavel, a guy who tried to pass himself off as a film producer, along with his wannabe friend, played by Tommy Davidson.
Well, we call them the BS brothers for obvious reasons. But these are guys, these characters came out of the fact that literally, when this show hit, I don't think, any, you know, television is so immediate that we came out, we did the pilot, and when I would go and do other work, because we waited almost a year before we did the show, everyone had seen this pilot. As a matter of fact, the show got reviewed before it got picked up by Fox. It got a review in, like, Vanity Fair. Because someone had started making copies of the pilot, bootleg copies, and they were all over the country. Everyone had seen this show, and they loved it. So when the show first went on the air, there was no security, really, and people were just wandering around the halls, and you would always see these guys. I mean, these kinds of guys that were always hustling, always trying to get, you know, get over. And they would, like, burst into Keenan's room when he was getting made up. And, you know, with the cards and everything. So these are real people. And any time you come to see our show, you will see them in the green room. Actually, the BS brothers.
Oh, this is it, homie. This is the green room. Is Madonna down here somewhere?
I'm Madonna's manager. She's on stage. Can I help you?
The man himself? Look here, homie. I'm Clavel. Now, I know Madonna must have mentioned me because we go way back. My cousin Boudreaux delivered some flowers to a guest house one time last year.
No, men on film. This is a sketch that recurs that you and Damon Wayans starring this one. It's a kind of takeoff on Ebert and Siskel, but you're two very swishy gay critics.
Yeah.
How did this one come about?
Like, that those characters started out as they were going to be two brothers. You know, they're going to be Dickie and Donnie somebody. And a lot of people tried it. You know, a lot of times we'll read it if it doesn't work with one actor, you try it with another one, and, you know. So they passed it around. And when Damon and I read it, initially it wasn't the sketch that you see. Initially, the films that we reviewed had really nothing to do with our personal points of view. And so we changed it around, and it really clicked. When we did that for the pilot, the curtain came up, and the audience just went insane. And by the end of the sketch, I knew it was going to be a big thing, but I didn't know it was going to be that big.
Now I'd like to talk about a film I've been anxiously waiting to see, Great Balls of Fire.
I ain't going to touch it, but the title alone gets 2 snaps up.
About some films that are soon to come out on video. First up is Dangerous Liaison, starring John Malkovich and Glenn Close. You know, John Malkovich is like every moviegoer's fantasy. I find myself just alone at night just thinking about his intensity. Yeah. What you think of Glenn Close?
Oh, I loved him. And I really have to admire the producers for daring to cast a man in that role. I mean, that really made the picture for me.
Hello? Glenn Close is a woman.
Clutch the pearls. What a sneaky thing to be.
Well, looks like we're almost out of time. Would you join us next week when we talk about Mel Gibson's Lethal Weapon?
I hope it's loaded.
You crazy.
You know, I should mention here that this sketch has been criticized by some gays for being a homophobic, stereotypical. Do you think it's offensive, and do the criticisms bother you?
No, the criticisms don't bother me because we've gotten like twice, three times as many letters from gay viewers that say they love those characters, and that please do more, do it every week. Why aren't you doing them? Why did you take them off? And that kind of thing. So, and I also think in comedy, you know, if you get no criticism, if everyone's happy, then you're not doing your job, you know. I think that we do not criticize a lifestyle, and we don't pass judgment on a lifestyle. It is definitely a caricature based on, you know, real people. But we didn't single out this particular group. We beat up on everybody. But I don't think it's a malicious thing. Our humor is not a malicious thing, you know. Absurd, grotesque, bigger than life, yes, but not the kind of thing that you don't deserve to live. You're the reason why, you know, our society's screwed up. We don't do that kind of stuff.
My guest is David Alan Greer. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's TV Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1991 interview with David Alan Greer, recorded when he was one of the stars of the sketch comedy show In Living Color.
Now, a character you've done a lot is an old blues singer, an old blind blues singer, or is he really blind?
Yeah, right. Calhoun Tubbs. Calhoun Tubbs is like the worst blues singer in the world.
Thank you very much. All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Calhoun Tubbs. Known to my friends as Hard Fingers. See, that's because back in 1947, I once played the guitar for over 36 hours straight for no reason at all. That's right. I wrote a song about it. Like to hear it, here go. I played guitar for 36 hours for no reason at all. Thank you very much. You know, I'd like to welcome y'all to my 75th anniversary show. That's right. 75 years in the business of the blues. Still trying to make it. I wrote a song about it, like the kids here go. 75 years in show business, and I'm still trying to make it.
I was doing a movie in Canada, and my wife and I, we went to this little bar, and I said, wow, you know, this old blues guy is there. And there are all these white people were packed in this little coffee house, and this guy had to be the worst. He couldn't play guitar. He couldn't sing. You know, his songs were terrible. And yet there were all these kids, you know, like all these college students were packed around him like he was a messiah, you know, like this guy was
authentic.
A real blues singer. And we were in the back laughing our heads off, man. So that was the idea for Calhoun Tubbs, this guy who's really terrible, a terrible blues singer, but he's got a lot of heart.
And people fall for him.
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, another character I like a lot, this was not a recurring character, but this was a sketch you starred in called John's Sidekick.
Oh, you know, I loved that sketch. And we kept trying to bring him back, and we probably will next year, but we just couldn't find the right thing. And John's Sidekick is just, you know, just what it is. It's like in every action-adventure movie, you know, there's always, the white guy is always the one who gets shot, he takes the fall, he beats everybody up, and, you know, he has a black sidekick who never does anything. You know, he never gets the girl, but he's always there as the best friend, you know, the generic asexual sidekick, and that was our tribute to him.
Yeah, and as John's sidekick, like you wouldn't cross, you know, against a red light. You know?
Right, yeah, yeah.
You have to play everything by the book.
He follows the book by the book. John's Sidekick. Yeah, I like that, man. As a matter of fact, when we were shooting that in Los Angeles, the guy was chasing me, and the police pulled up. You know, they screech up there, and it was really funny, you know. So the guy had to put the gun down, and we all, you know, were up against the fence and the whole thing.
Oh, jeez. So what happened?
nothing. We got out alive. You know, thank God there was a camera there, but it was, you know, we knew it was going to happen.
Really?
It was so strange. We did know. Yeah.
How did he treat you before he found out that you were shooting something?
Ah, man. You know, there was a camera there, you know, and there's two black guys. We both have guns, but there's a camera there. So it would make sense to you that we're not, like, robbing anybody. But, you know, I'm just glad the camera was there. Or else it could have been a long night. You may have been looking at videotapes of me instead of Rodney King. You know.
David Alan Greer, recorded when he was one of the stars of In Living Color. This fall, he stars in a new NBC sitcom called DAG, playing a Secret Service agent assigned to guard the First Lady and her children. Our TV week continues tomorrow on Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's program on variety and sketch comedy shows was produced by Roberta Shurrock with Patty Leswing. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Anne Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I can't watch this. I can't watch this. I can't watch this. I can't watch this. My TV makes me so bored, makes me say, oh my lord, what is this garbage here? Wanna cover my eyes and plug my ears? It sucks, and that's no lie, it's about as much fun as watching paint dry. Lowers my IQ one notch, and that's the reason why, I can't watch. I told ya, homeboy, I can't watch this. Yeah, nothing but trash, and you know, I can't watch this. Poke out my eyes, man, I can't watch this. Yo, give me that remote control.
I can't watch this.
Talking about sick shows is America's funniest home videos. I can't believe my eyes when I see the kind of stuff that wins first prize. Somebody's poor old mom falls down off the roof, lands right on the lawn, face first on a rake. I hear they got it on the 17th take. That's funny. That's a kick in the crotch. And that kind of show, I can't watch. Yo, I told you, I can't watch this. Change the channel now, man. I can't watch this. Yo, pass the TV guide here, sucker. I can't watch this. Cosby Show and Roseanne think I've taken about as much as I can. Judge Wapner, oh my, you gotta be Rain Man like this guy. 30 something. It's alright if you like hearing yuppies whining all night. Can't stand Twin Peaks. Wish they'd lynch those donut-eating freaks. Those Siskel and Ebert bums ought to go home and just sit on their thumbs. That's word because you know I can't watch this. I can't watch this. Down.
Here's hot oil, money back guarantee.
Removes tough stains fast.
It tastes more like fresh peanuts.
They keep going and going.
Don't hate me because I do.
Could be dandruff.
Our prices are insane!
Stop. Prime time. I'm pretty sure I'll be sick if I have to watch another stupid pet trick.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Dell Paperbacks division, publisher of The Complete Book of Food Counts, 5th edition by Corinne T. Netzer, with updated listings. This is NPR, National Public Radio.